Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey everyone, Late Night is off this week, but please enjoy this special edition of the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. Today you'll hear Seth's interview with Senator Al Franken, which they recorded live at Cooper Union in New York City on August 1st, 2017. Special thanks to the Strand Bookstore for presenting the talk. Now let's go to Seth and Senator Al Franken.
Michelle Bachmann. That's what I was out for. You were senator when I went out. Do you remember?
I think you may have come out twice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I came out. I do remember I came out. Well, I want to talk about this because I came out to Minnesota, and it was really wonderful because you told me so many really funny stories about the Senate. And I've been really dining out on that because it's exciting. I know a lot of people in comedy. I only know the one senator. And your stories were fantastic, and I feel like this book is a lot of those stories that you have only been able to tell friends and acquaintances, and now what made you finally decide to share all these insider stories with everybody?
Well, first of all, after, and I write about all this in the book, when I first got to the Senate, I had won by 312 votes. And so I was seated about 6 months late. And it was so close, and my opponent, Norm Coleman, the Republican, everything I had ever said or written in comedy through this machine called the Dehumorizer, which was built with very state-of-the-art Israeli technology, and it took the humor out of every joke I'd ever told. It was a vicious, vicious campaign. So I could not. When I got to the Senate, I said, I can't. You know, I want the people of Minnesota have to know that I'm serious about this, and I'm going to be a workhorse and not a show horse. So I spent the next 5.5 years doing that, and I got reelected by a very comfortable margin in 2014. Thank you. And then I went, hell, now I can be funny.
Yeah. And you said you had to show people you were a workhorse and not a show horse. I came down for the Mark Twain Award. Tina Fey was getting it. And Amy Poehler and I came and had lunch in your office.
Right.
And then you walked us around the Senate, and we felt like you were telling us every joke that you felt like no one you worked with would get. And so I actually feel like my analogy would be that you were a racehorse that was not let out of your stable. until you got to write this book? Because you seemed so repressed with all this comedy that you did not have the right audience for.
Now, I could be funny with my colleagues on the floor. We had rules. I could be funny on the floor with my colleagues as long as it wasn't too loud. Mm-hmm. And so my colleagues, you know, right away, because a lot of the Republicans I was worried about, because I had spent a lot of my career in satire writing, you know, heaping scorn and ridicule on Republicans. So I thought they might be wary of me. But they got it right away. And a lot of my colleagues, where I told you this, when we had 60 senators at this time, 60 Democrats, and there were only 40 Republicans at that time.
It can't happen. It can't happen.
So one day I just went over to the Republican side with Risch and holy moly, Mike Crapo. So Risch and Crapo, and I go over there and I go like, "Oh my God, it's so crowded over there." I just had to come over here to breathe. And they got it. They thought I was funny. And also, I laugh a lot. And so it took like a day for my colleagues to go, "Oh, I get it."
Yeah.
You know, he became a comedian because he's funny and he likes to laugh. So that was quick. But I couldn't be publicly funny.
You talk in the book, there's a moment where you actually, you write in the book about both the angel and the devil on your shoulder arguing with you about the joke that you want to tell.
Yeah. So I had told a mild joke that came out of the situation in the Sotomayor hearings. And she had said that she had, become a prosecutor. She had been a prosecutor because of watching the Perry Mason show. And I said to her, when it got to my questioning, "I think it's odd that you became a prosecutor watching a show where the prosecutor lost every case."
Yeah.
And she said, "Well, actually, Perry Mason lost one case." And I said, "Okay, well, we'll get to that later," not meaning not to. But then I had a 30-minute line of questioning. I had about a minute and a half left. I couldn't develop my last line of questioning. I said, "Okay, what case was it that Perry Mason lost?" And she said, "I don't know." And I said, "Didn't the White House prepare you?" And it got a big laugh, right? And this is like my seventh day in the Senate. But it wasn't, I thought the rule was like I couldn't think. That was just in reaction to what she said.
Right.
Oh my God, it was like, there were all these navel gazing pieces like, "Is Franken unable to not be funny?" And so I just went like, "Okay, can't say anything funny." So then like in, that was in July. In November, I'm in a hearing on the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA, and which is, there's still about 30 states in which you can get married now on a Saturday and Monday be fired for being LGBT. And so this was a law that Jeff Merkley from Oregon put forward to ENDA to say that you can't do that. You can't discriminate against people on basis of their gender identity or preferences or whatever. And so so I'm sitting in the hearing, and there's all these LGBT activists, and Tom Perez, who is then like the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, is going to testify. And there's about, I don't know, seven Democrats. I'm last. Not one Republican showed up. And that was incredibly unusual. Not even the ranking member. I'd never been in a hearing where the ranking member didn't show up. So there was not one Republican there. So I immediately went, wouldn't it be funny if I, when it got to me, to say, "I think it's a shame that none of the gay members of the committee showed up." And the devil over there, and the angel was going like, "Now, Al, you know why we came here? Oh, screw it! You know, they're all LGBT activists in here. They'll love it. They'll love it. You know, kill, it'll kill. Al, you know." And then I just had, all I could do was have this argument back and forth while everyone was doing their questions, and I'm going, And then the angel and the devil each got an angel and a devil. And the devil's angel and the angel's devil worked it out.
Okay. And it was, you managed to avoid it. You did your staff round.
You can be mildly funny from now on in spots.
Yeah.
This isn't it.
You talked about, that's a hard thing to give up because it would have killed. You also mentioned one of the reasons, if we're ever watching C-SPAN and we're seeing you speak, there's a reason you don't tell a joke that has nothing to do with this. It's impossible.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When I was first deciding whether to run, this is in 2005. I was trying to decide whether to run in 2008. I met with Jeff Blodgett, who was Paul Wellstone's campaign manager in all of his campaigns. And he said to me, just for an exercise, write a five-minute speech that has no jokes in it. And this is, I'm now, I just said, why would you want to do that? That what? But there's a reason you don't tell jokes on the floor of the Senate in a speech, because there's no one there.
Yeah.
No, you know, you think it's on a tight single of you, and you think there could be 99 other senators there, but there aren't. There's no one there other than staff and the floor staff. And so don't tell a joke, because it'll be silence.
Right.
And it'll die, you know, and at home it looks like, oh, he told the joke and it died.
Yeah.
You know, but no, there's no one there. So that's why you don't do that.
I remember being in Minneapolis with you, and we went out to dinner. Went to a restaurant with you and your wonderful wife, Franny. And they had a private room set up for us in the back. And you and Franny immediately said, there's absolutely no way we can sit in the back. We have to sit in the center of the restaurant. Do you remember that?
Well, we had to sit, not in the center. We had to sit in the, they saw we were going into a private room.
Right.
And I said, no. You know, Franny said, no.
Yeah.
And then we went out to.
And you, I remember you telling me that the reason is when you win by 330 votes.
312,
yeah.
But
you have to thank everyone.
Well, you have to thank everyone, and you can't lose a vote like, oh, that Franken.
Yeah.
Now that he's a senator, he thinks he's better than everybody. He's got a private room.
Yeah.
You know, we just don't do that.
You fly back and forth from D.C. to Minneapolis all the time, obviously.
Yep.
You've flown so much that you would get upgraded first class every flight just on miles, and you won't allow that to happen either, right?
No, because people assume if you're in first class, the government is paying for it.
Right.
And they aren't, either way. And also, yeah, I have free upgrades. You know, they know me now, so they don't give them to me.
Yeah.
But I just, no, I go fly coach, and it's fine. I mean, it's fine. I just.
Yeah, and I would imagine having your constituents walk by.
Yeah, but you don't want to tweet.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a picture of you in first getting a cocktail or something, and they're in coach. So, and it's amazing how many times people go, thank you for writing coach. Oh, thank you. That's so great that you're writing coach.
So, obviously, this is an interesting time. It's one of the reasons this book seems to be coming out at a good time. I want to talk about with Jeff Sessions, who's a friend, Senator Sessions.
Senator Sessions and I were friends.
Yeah. Watching the question you asked Jeff Sessions that got him in all this trouble, and you admitted the book, he answered a different question than the one you asked.
Right. It had just come out that some AP report that members of the Trump campaign had met with Russians during the campaign, continuous but this came out as AP, and I don't expect you to know it, but let me ask you this. If this turns out to be true, and you became Attorney General, what would you do? Meaning, would you recuse yourself? And he said, he just answered that he had, I've been a surrogate for the campaign, and I can just tell you that I didn't meet with any Russians during the campaign, or have communication with any Russians during the campaign. And I went, okay. And that turned out not to be true.
Right.
And this is, and you're testifying under oath, and those are pretty, he met him at the convention in Cleveland, meeting in his office with him during the campaign, and then it turns out he had another meeting with him at the Mayflower. Yeah. So then 7 weeks later, it comes out in the Washington Post that he had these meetings, and at that point, he recused himself. So a lot of people credit me with him recusing himself, and therefore Mueller, because then we have a special prosecutor, and they think that I, was playing three-dimensional chess. And I'm just four moves ahead of everybody else. And that I knew that he would pivot from the question, would you recuse yourself, to, well, I didn't even. And that's why we would get him, and he would recuse himself, and we'd get Mueller. And that was what happened. That was the case. That was it.
I want to go through some of your other. The book's wonderful, and your relationship with other Democratic senators is good reading. But it is fascinating to hear about the efforts you made with your Republican colleagues, Tom Coburn of Oklahoma. You made every effort.
Well, here's the thing. I was saying that DeMint has a sense of humor, which you wouldn't necessarily think. That Lindsey Graham, for example, is really funny. Really funny guy. Last year, when he was like running 15th out of like 17 in the Republican presidential primaries, I went up to him and I said, "Lindsey, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you." And he said, "That's my problem." And so I have a lot of funny colleagues. Tom Coburn of Oklahoma has no sense of humor. And I think he would say that. He would kind of acknowledge that actually sometimes. And he was on Judiciary, and sometimes he'd go, "I don't get Al's jokes." And so, but the first like three exchanges I had with him, we just, it didn't connect at all. So I went up to him, I was there about 2-3 weeks, and I said, "Tom, can I take you to lunch?" And he went, "Well, take me to breakfast." So I said, okay. So we met for breakfast a couple days later in the Senate dining room, and so it was about 8 in the morning. I said, "Look, Tom, for the next 40, 45 minutes, whatever it is, let's just have fun, okay?" And he goes, "Okay, fun." So I said, "Okay, we can talk about anything. We can talk about our families. We can talk about politics. We can talk about our careers before the Senate." And he was called Dr. No in the Senate because he had been a doctor. He was an obstetrician gynecologist. And also he said no to pretty much everything because he was so conservative and he didn't believe the federal government could spend money. So I said, "We can talk about politics. We can, talk about our careers, but let's have fun." He goes, "Okay." And so I said, "Okay, good. Let's talk about our previous careers. Let me ask you, to be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education?" And he said, "Yes, you've got to go to medical school." So I said, "Well, okay, Tom, that was a joke. And that's what I used to do for my career, you see." And so the Rex of the Breakfast was fun, and I, you know, I explained him what jokes were and what the proper reaction is to a joke. And we had, and then I got a note later from him saying I had a lot of fun.
That's great. You, it does not seem like you have some kind words for Senator Ted Cruz and his sense of humor. You don't completely.
Yes, for a sense of humor.
For a sense of humor.
This is the thing you should know about Ted Cruz. I probably like Ted Cruz more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz. And I hate Ted Cruz. Now, and one of the reasons I like him a little bit, he does value humor, I think.
Yeah.
I think. You never know with this guy. But he, I justify this in the book about he just, his word's not good. He's like a toxic coworker. He's like the guy that microwaves fish in the lunchroom.
And this is not a partisan. This is a nonpartisan issue.
No.
Like, it seems like Republicans also
I did
don't
have
like
a Republican say, I love the Cruz chapter. there's a story in the Cruz chapter. My senior senator, I don't know why in the introduction, the introducer, Caitlin, I think, said I had to say that I was a junior senator. Seemed very unnecessary, but but I am, and my senior senator, Amy Klobuchar, is very funny.
Yeah.
And Amy refuses to let me write jokes for her if she's in the thing. And she will let me look at them, though, and maybe punch them up a little bit. So she, in 2013, she was, got the, signed, she was asked to do the Gridiron Dinner, which mm-hmm. is this kind of humorous dinner, and she was taking the Democratic side. So she ran some jokes by me, and one was about Cruz. And this was, in 2013, this was just like a couple months after the Carnival Cruise that had gone out to sea and had been towed back after 10 days out there. And it got towed back because the engine died and nothing worked on the thing. It was called the Poop Cruise.
Yeah.
Remember that? Called the Poop Cruise because there was stuff. It was terrible. It was a terrible cruise. So she wrote this joke, her joke. She said, when most people think of a bad cruise, they think of Carnival, but we think of Ted. So I said, Amy, I've got a rewrite for it. But anyway, I'll tell you the rewrite. That will be the end of this one. So the Thursday before the Gridiron, or the Saturday of the Gridiron, I see Amy go to Chuck Schumer and ask him something. And then she goes to someone else. And I go like, oh, I see. She's clearing the jokes that she's telling about her colleagues. And then I see her head to Ted Cruz. And I go like, I just want to be part of this. So Amy kind of goes up to him. She goes, Ted, I have a joke. I'm doing the Gridiron. Doing the Gridiron on Saturday. I have a joke about you. I'd like to get your permission to tell it. He goes, well, what's your joke? And she says, well, it is when most people think of a difficult cruise. So she's changed bad to difficult. She's softened it. They think of Carnival. But we Democrats in the Senate think of Ted. So she said,
double
we
soften.
Double yeah. soften. So I'm going, all right, okay. And he goes, I'll tell you what. What if you changed it to a challenging cruise? And I see Amy kind of go like, okay, now it's just not funny. It's just not funny anymore. And he's smart. He's very smart. And,
yeah.
And he sees that and he goes, I'll tell you what. I believe in the First Amendment. You tell your joke. I go, oh, man. I go like, Ted, I actually have done a rewrite on Amy's joke, and I think it's a lot better. You want to hear it. And I see Amy go like, oh, my God. He's going to tell, and I want to be here for this. So Ted goes, sure. I go, okay. Here, this is the rewrite. When most people think of a cruise as full of they think of Carnival, but we think of Ted. And he, had argued, he was Solicitor General of Texas, he had argued cases in the Supreme Court. His reaction was, and then I walked away, so.
I feel like the world knows where you and I stand on the president. Are there times, though, that you think the president is funny?
There was once, I thought, one moment where I thought the president deliberately made me laugh. Okay. It doesn't matter. No, I don't think he's funny at all.
Did you see that they published this transcript of this Wall Street Journal interview he did? Oh, well, this is actually separate of that. They just, SI went golfing with him, and they're writing a story on golf.com where supposedly he told people at Bedminster, members of his club, he said of the White House, that White House is a dump. And I actually thought the writing of that is that's the funniest way of saying it. Like, the White House is a dump is pretty funny, but that White House is a dump. But he's like a funny character who sometimes says the funniest version.
Oh, yeah. No. The fact that he exists is in certain ways funny.
Do you have any faith or any hope that the Republican Party will adjust itself in any way?
I have hope.
Yeah.
I have hope. Mm-hmm. I think there are colleagues that I talk to. I know there are that I talk to who are distressed by the president and by his behavior, and they're just nervous, they're afraid, because his base seems to be sticking with him, more or less, and his base is kind of their base. So there are some that are very worried about distancing themselves or criticizing him, and I think that's them. They have to make that calculus. But there are some that have kind of been brave about this. Jeff Flake has been out front. Ben Sasse and some others.
It's funny, we try to get Republicans to come on our show, and the only ones we can get are Republicans who've spoken out against Donald Trump. We can get Ben Sasse to come on. We can get Lindsey Graham to come on. But the reality is you realize no Republican who supports him wants to actually come on and answer any questions about
him. Well, they may have noticed that at the beginning of your show very often, when you take a closer look, that is nothing but Trump bashing combined with bashing someone else in the Trump administration or one of his family. I mean, it just, so they may be going like, I'm uncomfortable. Identify coming on after a closer look, in which the president of the United States, who is with my party and who 86% of Republicans in my state love, and who I have to get the endorsement, I have to get the nomination in my state, and I can't possibly lose to a Democrat because I'm in a red, really red state. I'm not going to go on that show.
When you lay it out like that, I feel like I'm probably wasting my breath with the invitations.
Yeah, like, don't. Jim Inhofe is not going to go on your show. He might actually do it. That's why. Did you really need that explanation?
In general, I just like that we were talking about the show. I feel like that's good. SNL, it was very nice because obviously I grew up watching you on the show, and you were always very kind when I was at the show. You were somebody who would stop by every now and then. You submitted some sketches.
Yes.
You submitted a sketch more than once, the same sketch.
Right.
There was a sketch called Fart Doctor.
Fart Doctor.
Fart Doctor never even went to dress.
No.
It never went good enough at the table to even go to dress rehearsal.
Now, here's what happened. The week Al Gore hosted, former vice president, asked me to come in as a guest writer, and I wrote on that show. And, you know, I hadn't written for a long time, so I wrote a fair amount of stuff, including Fart Doctor. And I realized that, I'll tell you what the sketch is. Okay. So it's three doctors in their white doctor coats who are complaining about this doctor that's showing up that he's late. And two of the doctors are very skeptical about him. And one of the doctors say, I'm telling you, he is the best diagnostician in the world. He's from Duke. He can diagnose. We don't know what's wrong with these people. We've been unable to diagnose them. He is the best in the world. So he comes in. And, you know, Al Gore, I can't be Fart Doctor. So I held it. I held it for another host. And then the Fart Doctor comes in. I just called it Fart Doctor on a lark.
Yeah.
Because the word, but what happened
it's
is.
It's a pretty good title for what this doctor ends up being.
No. Well, and so the doctor comes in and he's read all the files of each the cases. And he said, I'm ready for the first patient. And the first patient comes in, and he says, I want you to fart. And what? And then the other doctor says, no, it's, you know, okay. And he works up and farts, and he goes, is your mother half Silesian? The guy goes, yes. Did you have tabbouleh salad today? Yes, I did. Okay, you have, and then it was some disease that the other doctors couldn't diagnose, and they all go, that's amazing. And he goes, it's okay, you're going to be okay. All we need to do is this and this and this, and you're going to be fine. The guy goes, oh, thank God, boom. Okay, next one comes in. Then as that one goes out, he takes out an electric fan, little one of those little ones.
Right. Because you don't want to misdiagnose the next patient.
Yeah.
With the previous.
So he does that.
Yeah.
And that's Fart Doctor, okay?
Yeah.
So. And you know, it has a good build. There's a patient who's just a big asshole, and it turns out that he's terminal, and everybody's happy.
Yeah.
You know, all the other doctors hate him, and okay, that guy's. And then. At the end, they have a guy who just can't do it, and then he says, this doesn't make any sense. And it turns out that it was going to be Amy Poehler that farted, and he says, oh, my God, we got to get you to surgery right away.
Right.
And that was the end of the sketch.
Yeah.
So it was a perfect sketch. So I kept submitting it. I go, like, Christopher Walken, he could be the fart doctor,
yeah.
You know? And then so I would – but when you're not there – talk people through the sketch. So
I can't believe you think the problem was you weren't there to explain it to us. Like that, a room full of comedy professionals at the top of their game couldn't wrap their head around this premise.
It was the way you perform, anyway. You know that.
You called me on the phone, and you would give me line readings for how to do my character.
Yeah. I'm still confused. Now here's the thing that just. Pisses me off about it is
yes,
that
please.
Is Tina Fey.
Yes.
Okay. So Tina Fey, in her 30 Rock show, has the show within the show, right?
The girly show.
Yeah. And
that was what it was originally called.
Yeah.
Episode one.
Yeah. And Fart Doctor becomes a running joke.
Yeah.
They gotta, you know, we gotta go block Fart Doctor. And when she meets Matt Damon, who becomes her love interest. I think he's a pilot, right? And she meets him, and I think the first she kind of lies about who she is, and then finally she says that she writes for the show that she writes for. And he goes, "Oh, you know what I love on that show is Fart I write those. I write those. And I really, you see Tina every once in a while,
yeah.
Right? She owes me money.
Yeah. It's true. It's true. You talk, and it's
I'm
actually...
I'm so glad we've been, we've cleared the air.
You talk about...
Thank you.
That was wonderful. Well, I, you know, because Fart Doctor noticeably absent from the book, so I wanted to make sure that we got...
I did not, paperback. I got.
Do you remember, do you remember during 2008, I haven't mentioned this to you yet tonight, but do you remember you called me and pitched an idea?
Mm.
I won't go into the details of it, but you pitched a, do you remember it?
I do.
And it was a sketch about the election.
Okay, I kept having to say, you know, I'm Al Franken and I approve this message, right?
Yeah.
And I'd see these ads that were just scurrilous lies. And John McCain would go, I'm John McCain, I approve this message. So I thought it'd be funny. And that was the only idea I had.
Yeah.
It'd be funny to have John McCain, who Daryl Hammond played in a very funny way, to have him have to record that, which you only have to record it once
right.
for audio. But to keep recording it, on, and the ads would become more and more ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And then you, like an idiot, put – there's a – there's an ethic in comedy writing, which is, in at least at SNL, that you put the name, you put the names of who wrote the sketch, and you put the name of the guy who thought of the idea first.
Right.
So, like an idiot, he puts my name on.
Now, I will admit I was an idiot, but it was done from the right place. It was, I was being ethical. I genuinely was. I wasn't trying to burn you.
No, no, no. I know. I know. And, but boy, it was not helpful.
No. Because the press picked up on it right away.
Yeah, it somehow leaked out.
Yeah.
Because there's only 80 people at read through.
But I always felt bad about that. But it was a really fun sketch, and thank you. You talk about...
I barely had anything to do with it.
Look, it's too late. Your name was on it. I don't know. Can't get out of it now. You talk about Tom Davis, who was also one of the most wonderful people I ever got the chance to meet on the show. A legend. You guys started together.
Franken and Davis.
Franken and Davis.
High school.
And that... I was always so jealous of Andy Samberg, Yoram Tacone, Akiva, how long they knew each other.
Right.
So you were how old when you meet Tom?
I was 15.
Yeah.
And he was, I guess, 14. You know, so we knew each other in high school, and we went to this school together, and we performed in the school, and then we started performing at a place in Minnesota. It was like Second City, and in high school. And we were a team for years and years and years and years. And Tom died. Wonderful thing of Lorne to do.
Really funny, really sweet stories. He outlived his diagnosis.
Yeah, he had been diagnosed. He was given a year to live at the most, and he lived 3 years, and he kept apologizing to people. He was incredibly, he grew up, he said. This is what he said to me. Because we had broken up because he was an alcoholic and drug user. And he never stopped. When he got that diagnosis, he just grew up. And the way he went out was really a gift to me. Does that mean, who has the book? Because I want to read something.
It's right here.
Oh, we have Of course.
Do you need a water?
Oh. God, you talk show hosts. So funny. Okay, so let me figure out where this is. Hold on.
I was going to ask you to read something from this.
No, what I'm going to read is, basically, I did this eulogy for Tom after he died
in the Senate.
In the Senate. I'm a crier, so I had to do it, like, practice it, like, 40 times. And so I could do it. And I made it all the way to rest in peace. And so this is the next day I was sitting in a Judiciary Committee hearing when a staffer slipped me a note. Leader Reed is on the phone for you. It was unusual for the majority leader to call me in the middle of the hearing. I got up, went to the ante room, and picked up the phone. Harry? Al, I read your eulogy to your friend, who's quite a guy. Yes, sir, he was. I love this part, the dark side of death. I smiled. Then Harry read a passage from a piece Tom had written about dying. In the foreseeable future, I will be a dead person. I want to remind you that dead people are people, too. There are good dead people and bad dead people. Some of my best friends are dead people. Dead people have fought in every war. Then Harry said, it's perfect. Yes, I said, perfect.
That's really lovely. Hopefully, there was something else, because again, you talked about how he grew up and had this very noble end of his life. And there's another great line that Tom has. I hope I'm saying your line right, where you basically say that you would like to go, when you go, you would like.
Oh, yeah. I said, you know, the way you've been going out, this is a few days before he died. And I said, the way you've gone out has been a gift to me. And I hope, you know, I don't go out the way you do. He said, I hope you go out faster. He was, you know, Tom had a very sardonic sense of humor. He was a sweet, sweet guy.
But yeah.
Very sardonic, and he was a little bit more sardonic in those days.
The Legend of Al Franken at SNL, a story I've always wanted to ask you about that I've always heard, was about George Harrison coming up on the 17th floor, sitting at a piano. Is this correct?
Yeah, let me tell this because... just to get it right.
Yeah.
This is not in the book.
Right.
This is not in the book. So, George Harrison was one of the Beatles. And, you know, you're head writer.
Yeah.
And the show gets written essentially Tuesday night, Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
Late night, early morning. And so, prime time for writing, I'd say, is between 8 p.m. and 3 or 4 a.m. Don't you think?
Yep.
Would that be fair? So George Harrison shows up at the office and goes into Lauren's office, and everybody, there's a Beatle, and it's not Ringo. There's a Beatle in the office on the 17th floor. Nothing happens. Okay, so this is about 8 o'clock or something like that. And there's like, no one will do anything. I'm a producer at this point. I'm going like, guys, we got to write the show. George Harrison's here. So then Lauren and George go out to dinner. So now we start to get to work. Well, 3 hours later, they come back from dinner. And remember, Harrison's very drunk. Okay. So I go into my office, and I slam the door as hard as I can, and I didn't see it because I did from the inside. But evidently he, like, jumped out of his, out of the piano bench, like, about 3 feet, and then left. And I saved that week's show.
Yeah. And I'm sure everyone appreciated it and looked back on it with...
Yeah, well, I still have people from that. Shannon Bond. I saw her out in L.A., and she just was still cursing me.
thank you so much. Such an honor to be with you, Senator Franken. Really appreciate it. The book's fantastic.
Thank you, Seth.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.